From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this Friday edition, Iran has been busy this week harassing, now threatening, the U.S. Navy, reportedly launching a military satellite and continuing their misinformation about the origins of the coronavirus. And I'm sure I'm missing something on that list. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo joins me in just a moment with more on Iran's activities. And this morning, Nancy Pelosi, defending Joe Biden's call for a mail-in ballot election, said this.
We also have to save our liberty, the life of our democracy. And voting by mail is central to this in any event, but at the time of the coronavirus, very essential.
Missouri Senator Roy Blunt, chairman of the Senate Republican Policy Committee, joins me for that discussion. And conditions for Christians in Nigeria continue to worsen. Leila Gilbert, FRC Senior Fellow for International Religious Freedom, will be here with more later. And today marks the 105th anniversary commemorating the Armenian Genocide, when the Turks of the Ottoman Empire expelled and systematically killed 1.5 million Armenians. Travis Weber is here with more on the relevance of this historical reminder. And we'll also have a discussion about best practices for churches here at home as they begin planning to reopen. So a lot to talk about today on this Friday edition. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at T Perkins. Let me remind you, if you've not yet downloaded the new Stand Firm app, new and improved, go to the App Store, download it. It'll alert you to when Washington Watch is coming on. Also, we'll help you stay in touch with your elected officials as they represent you, whether it's here in our nation's capital or in state capitals around the country. All right, there are over 2.7 million confirmed coronavirus cases around the world and over 900,000 cases here in the United States. While the U.S. and other countries work to find a solution to the pandemic, nations like Iran and China are playing the blame game, saying the virus originated in America, being spread by U.S. troops. Considering the virus had not even arrived in the United States while China was in lockdown because of the virus, that finger-pointing, well, it looks like it's headed the wrong direction. Joining me now to talk about this and more concerning Iran is the U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. Secretary, welcome back to the program.
Tony, it's great to be with you today. Hope you're doing well.
Well, I'm doing fine. It is Friday. That's always nice when we come to the end of the week. And I'm sure you've had a busy week with what's been happening. I'll just stick with Iran, for one. As they have reportedly launched a military satellite, revealing a space program that many were not aware of. What do we know about this? Is this real?
Well, Tony, thanks for asking. It is real. This is a program that has been talked about some. The United States government has had its eyes on for a period of time, but Iran has denied to the world. They have said that they're missile program was purely peaceful, that they were working on satellites for the sole purpose of commercial activity. And then this past week announced that their IRGC leadership team had launched a military satellite into orbit. You'll recall these are the same air and space leaders that shot down a Ukrainian Airlines flight, killing 176 innocent civilians now several months back. This is a regime that, in spite of all the challenges that the world is facing today, continues to be the largest world sponsor of terrorism and the most anti-Semitic nation on the world stage.
Well, Mr. Secretary, I mean, given the technology that they used, or the technology that's used in space programs, very similar to that used for ballistic missile programs, this would suggest that they've made tremendous progress in a ballistic missile program that is concerning to the entire world, is it not?
Well, you'll recall, Tony, when the previous administration entered into the JCPOA, one of the theories was that the deal would slow Iran down from doing just that, building out the weapon systems that could threaten the United States from a nuclear weapon on top of a missile that could travel throughout the region, or indeed a long-range weapon system that might even be able to reach America. And what you can see is that the money that was given to them under the previous agreement has enabled them to make significant advances. We've been doing our best with our pressure campaign, our diplomatic effort, our deterrence effort, our economic effort to make the Iranian regime less capable, less well-resourced, but they're still there. And in spite of the fact that they're having all these internal challenges from the virus, they continue to build away, chip away, showing that they have the real intention of continuing to develop those systems to threaten America and threaten the world.
That's the only explanation would be that this was from the windfall that they received from the program previous under the previous administration, because their economy is about to implode from all indicators internally. So they're hurting. This had to be money they had squirreled away from other sources.
We've seen the regime try to use the COVID situation to demand that the United States cease its sanctions campaign against Iran on the theory that we were not allowing humanitarian assistance to be reached or medical assistance couldn't get to Iran. But I think the system's firing and the activities they took place this week where they challenged an American ship in the Arabian Gulf, I think that demonstrates the lie. The lie that the regime hasn't squirreled away tens or hundreds of billions of dollars. What it really tells you is they have that money, they have the resources to continue to build out these programs, to continue to threaten the world, but they choose to use it for those systems, to foment terror rather than to feed and to clothe and to provide the medical assistance that the people of their own country need. That's why we make very clear we are wholly supportive of the Iranian people, and we're simply asking that the regime change the nature of its behavior and begin to comport with the norms of civilized society.
Yeah, you would think in the midst of this crisis and an already troubled economy that they would turn resources to help their people. But it appears that this is a flexing of the muscle, very similar to the leader of Iran's Revolutionary Guard, General Salami, who basically warned yesterday that his forces would take on the U.S. Navy after the president had given them instructions not to be harassed by the Iranian rowboats that are out there in the sea.
Look, the good news for the American people and your listeners should know is that this administration responded very differently than the previous one. You'll recall not too terribly long ago when that same force, the IRGC Navy, took 10 U.S. Navy men, put them on their knees, took them off their ship, that the previous Secretary of State apologized and said, hey, can we get our folks back? I assure you that President Trump and Secretary Pompeo will take a very different response to that. And
I saw the statement
this fellow made yesterday. I think he knows that President Trump is serious about defending Americans, making sure that our soldiers and sailors and airmen who are in the region and defending America and deterring us from that threat have all the capability, all the tools, and all the authority they need to respond if they are challenged.
And the will in this administration to take care of that, which is so refreshing, because as a veteran, that was a tragic, tragic day when the Iranians captured those naval personnel. And it was humiliating, I think, to the nation. And the way we responded to that was, in my view, was deplorable. So I think a lot of Americans applaud the unequivocal position that this president takes, America first. But I want to continue with Iran, because they were involved in other activity this week. Even, you know, my grandmother used to say that, you know, watch out who you hang with, because birds of a feather flock together. And Iran working with Venezuela, propping up their refineries, trying to get them money into Venezuela. What do we know about what they're doing at our back door?
Certainly, they have for months now been working with the Maduro regime to try and prop it up, to try and allow it to continue. Your point on birds of a feather is very well taken. I thought you were going to mention that this week they also worked on a disinformation campaign alongside the Chinese Communist Party, where the two of them both put out messages suggesting that somehow the United States might be responsible for the virus that clearly originated inside of Wuhan, China. Those are the kind of things that autocracies do, that regimes that don't value human life do, whether it's the Iranian regime or the Maduro regime. These are nations that don't care about individuals and about people, and they do often end up working together, trying to undermine democracies and freedom-loving people and those of us who appreciate the capacity to practice our faith in the way we want in other countries around the world.
Yeah, well, that was actually on my list to get to, was what I call the triangle of tyranny. You got China, you got Iran, but you also have Russia putting out the same message there. I don't know if they've all gotten together or they're just copying each other in the messaging, which is it's kind of, I don't know, it just doesn't add up. This breaks out in China in November. They're in lockdown. It makes its way to the United States in February. And we started it. It's a bioweapon that we created, and we unleashed it on our own people. Is that the thinking?
That's the story that they have tried to propagate. We've asked them to knock it off. The world knows that that's not the case. The world knows where this virus originated, right? We saw what happened in Wuhan, China. We saw that there were tens of thousands of people left Hubei province while the Chinese government was aware that this virus was continuing to spread, and they didn't alert the world in a timely fashion and created enormous cost and risk to the world. We're still trying to figure out precisely how that came to be. It's important our epidemiologists, our scientists, not only Americans, but those from all across the world, need to understand more about this. And we've asked the Chinese government, who tells us they want to be cooperative. We've said we want to cooperate, too, but that requires an openness and a transparency that we've not been able to achieve just yet. I hope that we can, because this is ongoing, and we continue to need that transparency about their weapons labs, their bio labs, all the places that this might have emanated from, so we can track down the original source of this virus inside of China.
So, Mr. Secretary, let me ask you that question, because I know I have a lot of confidence in our intelligence community and our ability as a government to track these things down. Without Chinese help and assistance in this, which in fact, if this is embarrassing to them, they most likely will not be helpful. But do we think that we'll get to a point where we can identify the source of this virus if, in fact, it did come from the lab in Wuhan, China?
Tony, I don't know the answer to that for sure. I hope that we can collectively do that. I saw Chancellor Merkel yesterday. I've seen leaders all across the world who have made clear the responsibility that every nation has, that China in particular has, since this epidemic broke out there. To open up, to let us get the information they need. We'll work hard to do that and find out the answers to those questions. If we get their assistance and consent and help to do it, that would certainly make it more straightforward. But if they don't, it's important that we know, not only so that there can be appropriate accountability with respect to it, but also so that we can put in place systems and processes that reduce the risk that the world will ever suffer from the massive loss of life and the economic calamity that has happened as a result of this epidemic coming out of Wuhan, China.
Absolutely. Extremely important. General Secretary, we're out of time, but very quickly on the way out. Last time we talked, you were bringing Americans back. Is that mission accomplished? All those that were stranded, are they now back on American soil?
That's a great question. Not mission accomplished yet, but almost 70,000 souls brought back so far. There's still a handful more, and we're still hard at it.
All right. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, as always, great to talk with you, my friend. Thanks for being
Tony.
On the program.
Have a great day,
You too. Have a great weekend. All right, folks, to find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. A great American. Very grateful that he is where he is. Coming up next, we're going to take a look at mail-in balloting, which, oddly enough, Democrats really big on for this fall's national election. Missouri Senator Roy Blunt joins us next to talk about that and more. Don't go away. Lots more Washington Watch still to come. Is historic masculinity lost forever? Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in a culture of gender confusion? We need men to be men. Tough with compassionate strength, bent toward justice without compromise, locking arms and standing. We need to be the men God created us to be and fight for all that is right, true, and just. This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join us at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference. To find out more, go to standcourageous.com. This conference is led by men who are seasoned, compassionate men who understand the issues of the day and will invest in you, helping you understand your role as a defender, a provider, an instructor, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, so that you can have the generational influence that God has designed you to have. Learn more at StandCourageous.com. That's StandCourageous.com.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood is the primary supplier of abortions in the U.S.? According to Planned Parenthood's most recent annual report, it committed over 345,000 abortions in fiscal year 2018. That means, on average, Planned Parenthood aborted 1,768 babies every single day in 2018. And while Planned Parenthood's report revealed an increase in abortions committed, many of the services they provide, such as breast exams and cancer screenings, have drastically decreased. FRC recently released its 2020 edition of The Real Planned Parenthood, Leading the Culture of Death. In this resource, you will find many facts revealing the truth, that Planned Parenthood is in the business of abortion, not healthcare. To access this resource and to find out more, go to frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts. That's frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts.
We can all benefit from a good lecture. They inform you and grow you. But sometimes you can't make it in person to every talk, seminar, or lecture you'd like to. Fortunately, Family Research Council now has a new podcast, so you won't miss out. FRC's new weekly podcast, called Lecture Me, was created to help inform and equip listeners on the biggest issues affecting our culture today. Each episode presents a lecture selected from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast features today's top thinkers who address important issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Make sure to stay tuned after each lecture to hear FRC's thoughts on the content as they further discuss the topic at hand. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Welcome back. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. So good to have you with us on this Friday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, if you're listening, yesterday we had a poll question, and I'm going to give you the one for today. But it was this: do you believe it's time for state and local officials to give more freedom to individuals, churches, businesses, restaurants, trusting them to balance the coronavirus health risk with reopening society? 96% of you said yes. It's time. 4% said no. So the topic we're about to jump into, here's the question. I'm going to give you a jump on it. You text the word radio to 53445. That's 53445. I'll send you a link to take the poll. Do you have confidence in the integrity of a national election conducted primarily by mail-in ballots? Yes or no? This is Nancy Pelosi earlier today defending Joe Biden, who yesterday called President Trump's opposition to mail-in ballots, which have some problems, as being un-American. This is what Nancy Pelosi said today.
We also have to save our liberty, the life of our democracy. And voting by mail is central to this in any event, but at the time of the coronavirus, very essential.
Wow, that gives me a lot of confidence. Well, joining me now to talk more about this, Missouri Senator Roy Blunt. He's the chairman of the Senate Republican Policy Committee. Senator, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, great to be with you again.
Well, Senator, we have a lot of states now, this big discussion taking place in Washington and all across the country about projecting that we're going to need mail-in ballots, mail-in balloting on a much broader scale come this fall. Does that raise your level of concern?
Well, I think it does for a couple of reasons. One's just a very practical reason that adjusting from whatever system you have to a system with big changes is hard to do. It's hard to do in any election. It's particularly hard to do in a presidential election. And two is, while I think ultimately how a state conducts its election should be left to the state, not the federal government, I have concerns if you don't have real safeguards on who gets to cast that ballot and who actually receives the ballot and who collects the ballot. And all of those things have clearly presented problems already in states that have no excuse absentee voting, no witness to who votes, ballots in other states that just go out to everybody and don't come back, I think are things that any rational person should be concerned about.
100% agree. But there are those, especially in the media, who are now criticizing the president for raising questions about this. But it's interesting. In 2012, the New York Times had a report that noted that voter fraud involving mail-in ballots is, quote, vastly more prevalent than the in-person voting fraud that has attracted far more attention, election administrators say, end quote. In fact, just looking at some of the numbers from the 2016 election, now Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, garnering over 2.8 million more votes than Donald Trump. But according to the data that's out there, 6 million unaccounted mail-in ballots were never counted in 2016. That's more than twice her margin in the popular vote. I mean, this could you could easily manipulate the outcome of a national election if there is not proper processes in place.
Well, I think the reason that states have traditionally been very thoughtful about moving beyond this place where you have the traditional absentee ballot, and anybody that works from home, anybody that's had a long-term illness, has some sense of how that traditional absentee ballot system works, and that's not what we're talking about
right.
Here. We're talking about, one, people getting ballots without even asking for them,
right.
Or two, asking for them and getting them without any accountability as to whether they come back or not. In any election, a presidential election, a governor's election, a county official election, could be decided by ballots that are collected by somebody else and not sent in, ballots that are gotten out of somebody else's mailbox and marked for your candidate and sent in with an unwitnessed fraudulent signature, all of those kinds of things should be problems, and election officials should worry about that. I was the chief election official or a local election official in Missouri for 2 decades. Most of that 2 decades was focused on making it easier for people to register to vote, but also being always thoughtful that their right to vote was protected when you protect the election process. If the process doesn't have integrity, then everybody who participates in the process with integrity loses out in that contest.
And that's
Tony, they had an election that the Democrat majority reversed, that a Republican won in the 2000. I guess it was the 2016 election, maybe been 18. I guess the 2018 election, because of ballot harvesting, where people go get absentee
right.
ballots. They're sent out as absentee ballots and collect those and either send them in all together or in some other way, have control of that ballot for some time before it gets back to the polling place. This is the standard part of the process now in states that have overwhelmingly Democratic elected officials like California. Ballot harvesting is the one thing that in the House so-called election reform bill they didn't outlaw, even though they had just refused to seat a Republican member because of ballot harvesting.
Yeah, and California, in fact, that cost a couple of Republican seats out there. And to the point that you make about these, we're talking not about those who request a ballot because they can't get to the polls or they're sick or they don't want to they want to be protective of any kind of health risk. These are ones being sent out in the mail to everybody, which is what's being proposed. And as you pointed out, this is where the ballot harvesting comes in. And it makes particularly the elderly and others a target for those that would prey upon them and deprive them of their vote.
It does, and if anybody's involved in helping with that vote, if they want to, with somebody who is in a frail condition, they generally have a pretty good sense of who that person voted for, and then get to decide what to do with that ballot. And who knows that ballot didn't come in? Whoever checks that out, obviously about 28,000 times, nobody checked in recent elections.
Yeah, and then as I mentioned earlier, a lot of those ballots are never accounted for. Senator Roy Blunt, as always, great to talk with you. Have a great weekend.
Hey, you too. Great to talk with you, and hopefully we're going to win the fight both against the virus and for the economy.
All right. Folks, don't go away. We're coming back with more right after this.
What are you reading this spring? At FRCblog.com, we have timely and original commentary on the issues facing our culture today. Our blog is written by our policy experts, the Family Research Council team, and outside contributors. On our blog, you can read about a wide variety of topics, including religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture. Some of our most recent blog posts include, "To abandon the nuclear family ideal is to abandon being human." "Why does the abortion industry hate women?" "China uses coronavirus to oppress religious minorities," and many more. At Family Research Council, our mission is to advance faith, family, and freedom in the culture by helping you to live out your faith and to stand for truth. With our blog, we hope to help you do that. Stay informed and get the resources you need at FRCblog.com. Again, that's FRCblog.com.
The Fairness for All Act was recently introduced to the House of Representatives after the passage of the Equality Act. In response, FRC has come out with a new publication, The Unfairness of the Fairness for All Act. This act attempts to find a compromise between the First Amendment protection of religious freedom and the demands of the LGBT community. Despite having the best intentions, it is an ill-advised and poorly drafted bill that does not achieve its goal. If this act is passed into law, it would allow the federal government to impose a belief system and ideology about sexual behavior and identity on all Americans. The Fairness for All Act would negatively impact religious freedom, true equality, and the privacy and safety of women. To access this resource and to learn more, go to frc.org/fairnessforall. That's frc.org/fairnessforall.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. The website is tonyperkins.com. All right, let me give you the poll question again. If you'd like to participate, I will give you the results before the end of the program. Might be the very end, but I will give you the results. Do you have confidence in the integrity of a national election conducted primarily by mail-in ballots? That's what Democratic leadership, what they're pushing for. That states have to send out ballots, and some states are doing this. In fact, my home state of Louisiana is unfortunately pursuing this for the primaries in this summer that have been pushed back. But mark my word, they'll try to do it in the fall as well. This is very problematic, and we're going to talk about this a lot in the coming weeks. But anyway, do you have confidence in the integrity of a national election conducted primarily by mail-in ballots? I don't know. Maybe you think it's fine. But let me know. Text radio to 53445. Text radio, the word radio, to 53445, and you can participate in that poll question. Now, the focus here in the United States has been consistently over the last 6 to 8 weeks, the coronavirus. It's a big concern. You know, over 45,000 people who have died from it. But other issues continue to be problematic, as we were just talking about earlier in the program with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Iran launching a military satellite, but also in other parts of the world that we often talk about, the persecution of Christians continue, like in Nigeria, another attack by the Fulani radicals. They've raided a village, killing 4 and burned down 36 houses. Now, this is just ongoing. It's systematic. In fact, Nigeria, to me, is probably one of the most troubled spots in the world. And I know there's a lot of troubled spots, but because of the size of Nigeria, about 200 million people, it's the largest country on the African continent, and it's about to just blow up. And if we don't get a handle on things there, it's going to affect not only the entire continent of Africa, but even into Europe. Joining me now with more details is FRC Senior Fellow for International Religious Freedom, Lila Gilbert. Lila, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony. I'm happy to be here.
Well, Leila, give us the latest on this latest attack in Nigeria and where this kind of fits in a pattern that we've seen here recently.
Well, unfortunately, it's not just one recent attack. There have been several. In fact, it seems to be accelerating to the point where there's more than two a week in recent weeks. And what's happening essentially is that these Fulani so-called herdsmen, which I think you identified more accurately by calling them radicals, are coming into Christian communities. They are massacring people. They are stealing whatever they can steal. They are taking women captive and small boys, and or young women and small boys. And they are also burning, torching churches and schools and whatever. But the pattern is that it's Christian communities that are primarily attacked, I'd say almost exclusively. And so that's what's happening. They are getting a free pass from some people, claiming that this is a climate change issue and that they just don't know where to graze their flocks. And so they are, you know, forced into massacring Christians, which is a pretty lame excuse, but that's what we're hearing from some authorities.
Yeah. In fact, that is the official position of the UK. They have basically explained this away as a global warming issue, a climate change issue, and that's what's forcing people to kill one another. But there is clearly, and it's difficult, and I deal with this in my capacity at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. These things are not always cut and dry. Many of these issues are intertwined, but there clearly is a religious element here in these attacks. So you have a government, but what is the government doing to protect these Christians? Now, let me just, for our listeners' benefit, the population officially, this is official, but not what people really think. Officially, it's about 50-50, 50 Christian, 50% Muslim. But the president is Muslim. What do we see the government there doing to protect Christians and other minorities?
Well, it's a very sad situation because our President Trump has spoken directly about this to President Buhari, who is a Fulani tribesman. And he was put in office with great help from the Obama administration. So he has a little bit of a carte blanche, or at least he has had. I don't think he does anymore. But trying to get anything changed there is absolutely going nowhere at this point. The United States is going to have to become a little bit more engaged to get anything changed because that government is not doing a thing. And it's not just Fulanis, it's also Boko Haram. So you've got
right.
a couple of groups. And
right.
and nothing's been done about any of it, including Leah Sheribu, who is, you know, still in prison or still captive. Nothing's been done. We've tried everything, and so it's going to take a little bit more focus, I'm afraid.
So those that are, very quickly, Leila Gilbert, those that are focused most intently on this, what are they calling the United States government to do?
I think sanctions against Buhari would be one step. Finding better documentation so we can get this in front of people is another. And we Christians need to pray.
Yes, absolutely. We need to be praying for the persecuted around the globe, but Nigeria in particular, because it is intense and often overlooked. We often overlook Africa. Leila Gilbert, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
If you'd like to read more about what Leila has put out, go to the website tonyperkins.com and follow the links over. All right, today, the 105th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. Travis Weber joins me next to talk about why it's important we remember that. Where can young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of real manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of gender confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join us at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate men who understand the issues of the day and will help you understand your role as a defender, provider, instructor, battle buddy, and chaplain so that you can have the generational influence God has designed you to have. Learn more at StandCourageous.com.
Recently, a bill called the Fairness for All Act was introduced to the House of Representatives. In response, FRC has a new resource, the Unfairness of the Fairness for All Act. This act attempts to find a compromise between the First Amendment's protection of religious freedom and the demands of the LGBT community. But, unfortunately, it is a poorly drafted bill that would negatively impact religious freedom, true equality, and the privacy and safety of women. Learn more at frc.org/fairnessforall.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood is the primary supplier of abortions in the U.S.? According to Planned Parenthood's most recent annual report, it committed over 345,000 abortions in fiscal year 2018. That means, on average, Planned Parenthood aborted 1,768 babies every single day in 2018. And while Planned Parenthood's report revealed an increase in abortions committed, many of the services they provide, such as breast exams and cancer screenings, have drastically decreased. FRC recently released its 2020 edition of The Real Planned Parenthood, Leading the Culture of Death. In this resource, you will find many facts revealing the truth, that Planned Parenthood is in the business of abortion, not health care. To access this resource and to find out more, go to frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts. That's frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts.
We can all benefit from a good lecture. They inform you and grow you. But sometimes you can't make it in person to every talk, seminar, or lecture you'd like to. Fortunately, Family Research Council now has a new podcast so you won't miss out. FRC's new weekly podcast, called Lecture Me, was created to help inform and equip listeners on the biggest issues affecting our culture today. Each episode presents a lecture selected from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast features today's top thinkers who address important issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Make sure to stay tuned after each lecture to hear FRC's thoughts on the content as they further discuss the topic at hand. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, and I am glad you're with us on this Friday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, coming up next week, talking about international religious freedom, talking about Nigeria. Next Tuesday, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom will be rolling out its annual report. I'll be doing that most of next week, so Sarah Perry is going to be sitting in for me most of next week. So that's why I'm here on Friday to kind of get my last radio fix in before I spend a week kind of working on USERF business. But let me give you this poll question again so you can participate in it. Do you have confidence in the integrity of a national election conducted primarily by mail-in ballots? Yes or no? Text the word radio to 53445, and I'll send you a link to participate in that poll question. All right. You know, I actually got quite a few things I want to cover in this this segment. We were talking earlier about the persecution in Nigeria, which is, as Leila Gilbert was talking about, is accelerating. And that's problematic because I think it could become a genocidal situation where you could have you could be looking back on this 10 years later and say, wow, I wish we'd have done something. And again, it's not just going to affect the country of Nigeria. It's going to affect the entire continent of Africa and even into Europe as the refugees flee from there, which you've already had a few million have fled. But so I want to kind of put a historical perspective on this where, you know, we ignore some of these things and we look back on them, we commemorate them. But there's a reason we do that, because it's to be a reminder of not allowing these things to happen again. Today is the 105th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. This is where the Ottoman Turks, back in 1915, expelled and systematically killed about 1.5 million Armenians. Join me now to talk about the importance of this. Also, we're going to transition and talk about churches here in the United States preparing to reopen and what they need to do. Join me now for that conversation, Travis Weber, Vice President of Policy and Government Affairs here at the Family Research Council. Travis, welcome back.
Thank you, Tony.
And let's start with the 105th anniversary commemorating this genocide. Why is it important?
Tony, this is important for several reasons. We know its relationship with religious freedom, the question being genocide at the core of this issue, of this discussion. But, you know, primarily we kind of step back. It's important because this is a matter of history that everyone around the world, not just those who were affected more directly by this genocide against the Armenians, but frankly, it's important for everyone around the world to know this history. It's part of our human history. It's part of the long sad string of atrocities that have been committed throughout humankind's history. And this is one of those. And it's one that's often overlooked, or, you know, people know about it. It's not like it's unknown, but it's not discussed a lot. It's not widely shared or talked about. For all these reasons, it's important for us to continue to educate those around us, those in our circles and spheres of influence, and our educational systems to educate students with the reality of what happened in the Armenian Genocide, which was it's an atrocity, number one, but it's also a religious freedom question. It's important for all those reasons.
It's also I'm going to look at this as I do almost everything, which as Christians we should, from a biblical perspective. It's yet another reminder of the truth of Scripture and the fallen nature of man. I mean, we see these events repeatedly and we think, how in the world could that have happened? I mean, when you look at the atrocities, 1.5 million, we're talking men, women, and children. And we've seen this, you know, repeatedly through the 20th century. We saw just 20th century alone, we saw event like this after event. And really two questions. This is a reminder of the fallen nature of man and how evil and brutal man can be. But secondly, how we are prone not to act and allow these things to occur.
It is a reminder of all those realities, Tony. You know, when discussing his own evil plans to act against the Jewish people, Hitler referenced the Armenian Genocide. He referenced the fact that people hadn't heard about it and it wasn't known, and you know he could get away with his actions. This speaks to the importance of us continuing to bring to light the atrocities that are committed around the world, which are reminders, as you mentioned, of the fallen nature of man, of our propensity for evil, but also callings for the Christian to speak out and to act justly and to work for justice in these situations, which still today, in this matter, there are efforts ongoing to commemorate this as a genocide, which it is. It's a consensus of scholars. This was a genocide. It met the requirements for a genocide, including intent to wipe out a people based on certain characteristics. It's justice to move towards a recognition of that fact, a calling all governments to recognize and all people to recognize this fact. And it's still a struggle because of the intransigence of the Turkish government and in relationships, including that of the United States, where we've hesitated because of our relationship with Turkey to recognize this formally as a genocide in all respects.
It reminds me of a proverb, Proverbs chapter 24, where it reads, "Deliver those who were drawn toward death, and hold back those stumbling to the slaughter. If you say, surely we did not know this, does not he who weighs the hearts consider it? He who keeps your soul, does he not know it? And will he not render to each man according to his deeds?" And I think one of the reasons it's in there is to remind us and to prompt us to act when we see these types of things occurring. And we were just, I was talking about with Leela Gilbert earlier about what's happening in Nigeria. It's convenient to just to kind of turn away and say it's not our problem, but it is our problem, especially when we see believers being systematically killed and brutalized. It is our problem, and we have a responsibility to speak and to act.
Tony, if we don't speak out for some of these people, who will? You know, I mean, there are others who are able to speak out. So it's not like Americans are the only ones, but we certainly have a platform to do so. And there are certainly many who cannot speak out. Nigeria, we talked about. We're discussing the Armenians who were walked helplessly to their slaughter. If you read the accounts of this, it's tragic. Walked into the desert in a forlorn manner and just left to die. Today, North Koreans, Christians and others suffer under the heavy hand of the North Korean regime in silence, secret. They need people to speak out for them. So many do. This is why it's important for us to understand religious freedom and to practice it at home and abroad.
Yeah. And I know it can be overwhelming, and we're not saying America has to solve everybody's problems, but it starts with us first being concerned about our brothers and sisters, praying for them, and as we have the opportunity to deliberately and intentionally act. And we cannot skirt that responsibility. To whom much is given, much is expected. And we have been given a tremendous platform of leadership in the United States. And under this administration, Travis, evangelicals have been given a tremendous leadership role because this administration listens closely to the concerns of evangelicals.
They're listening to the concerns we have on religious freedom and other issues. And Tony, just taking it back a step to what, you know, people can feel overwhelmed, but we can start with a few minutes of prayer. We can use the material. We're trying to raise awareness on this, these things. We have a piece on the Armenian Genocide today on our blog. People can just short snippets helping raise awareness, pray based on those, just a few minutes per day. That will galvanize us toward the action steps, right? And that feeds into what we are sharing with the administration. It'll feed into a movement where our concerns are raised. And as you mentioned, the Trump administration is taking to heart concerns about religious freedom both at home and abroad.
And as we pray about these matters, we get the heart of God, which is essential to acting, because we don't want to act on our own strength and our own wisdom. We want to act as directed by and led by the Holy Spirit. Speaking of that, Travis, I want to transition to another topic. I spent the entire program yesterday talking about time to reopen society. And obviously a key part of this, Scott Rasmussen, who was on the program yesterday, said that in the polling he's done, the number one institution that people want to see open are the churches, more so than the radio. More so than restaurants, stores. And clearly far more than movie theaters and sporting events. So churches need to begin preparing now for the opening process. Now, we've said all along, abide by the CDC guidelines. We've got to be concerned about the members of our congregation as well as our communities, that we're protecting their health. But we can do both. And we've put together a document, a new document, that will serve as a kind of some guidance to help these churches put together a reopening plan.
That's right, Tony. And we have this resource up on our website at frc.org/church guidelines. It is a compilation of practical steps that churches can consider as they enter the phase where questions about reopening are starting to come up. Now, this is being prompted, obviously, by the discussion which the president, the administration have raised with Opening America. They have their plan out, which is at the White House website for Opening Up America Again. It lays out three different phases. The question for many is going to be, well, how does this intersect with churches and religious communities? So that's the what we want to speak into with this. And hence the need and us putting out this resource available on that link, also available on our resource website for church-related activities in general during the coronavirus, which is frc.org/church. We have this bit of tips up. We also have a summary of how the White House plan affects churches specifically. That's at frc.org/church opening, and it's also at the church website I mentioned. So a lot of new resources. We can break them down in more detail, but we hope folks will visit the website and see them there.
Well, as we talked about yesterday, you know, again, we believe that every establishment should use the CDC guidelines to ensure the health and well-being of their congregant, their customers, whomever it might be. But I also made very clear that As the president has given the states the right to and the ability to craft their own plans based upon their needs, those governments need to give churches and businesses that same freedom and give the American people credit. Because I think some people are not going to go out to church right away. In fact, a part of this guidance that is put out is that churches, pastors should encourage all attendees who are 65 years and above to stay home for a while and watch online, or you provide another type of service, maybe a senior-only service exclusively for those attendees 65 and above, or a drive-in service. But be creative, work within the guidelines. It means you might have to do a few more services than you normally do because you don't want to pack people in. I think we talked about this earlier in the week, and it's been incorporated in some of this guidance, what the state of Texas put out. They said, look, let family units sit together but keep 6 feet apart from another family unit so that you have that distancing. But be creative, but be cautious, avoid the risk. But we've got to begin reopening society. And from my perspective, and obviously the perspective of many, the church is essential to that reopening process.
Well, Tony, that is correct. And that's the gist of what we try to convey with this guidance, that among the items, the ones you mentioned, in addition, different steps that folks can consider, breaking this down really into health and safety for at-risk individuals, sanitation practices, other appropriate adjustments along the lines of what you mentioned, and then an encouragement to be on lookout for guidance from state and local officials that might violate religious liberty. We want to comply with reasonable guidance, but if it steps over the line, targets religion, we want to know about it. So that's the breakdown of what we hope is helpful to different churches and pastors out there as they enter this reopening phase. People and church pastors and churches are going to be encountering their own questions based on their specific situations. But these are hopefully going to help them guide themselves into those lanes as they approach the reopening.
Yeah, and it's time. I've done several interviews today, and I've made clear that I think churches, basically at the end of this month, will be 45 days. We're approaching 40 days. It's time. And churches are going to want it. They need to get back open. Businesses need to get back open. I've talked to had private conversations with a number of members of Congress who have heard from small businesses in their districts that, quite frankly, probably will not, if we don't get opened up in the next couple of weeks, will not open up. So it's a critical time. And again, I think churches have to be at the tip of the spear in providing the stability to a community. But we've got to do it wisely within the guidance. And so, Travis, I appreciate your team putting all that information together.
Tony, yeah, we hope this is going to be helpful and just an encouragement. The White House guidance includes mention of places of worship in their framework. And so there is a way for churches to approach this, but it's incumbent upon everyone to be proactive, to look at this for their own situation and develop a plan of attack for themselves.
All right. Travis Weber, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend. All right, folks, and thank you for joining us. It's been great being with you all week. And here on the way out is the results of our poll question. Doesn't happen often, but here it is. 100% of you say no. I have no confidence in the integrity of a national election conducted by mail-in ballots. All right, until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing, just 6 feet apart.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.